In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, October 3rd, 2014. A little bit under the weather today, but as always, I am at your service Monday through Friday with your daily serving of liberty education here on The Tom Woods Show. Make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, which you can easily do at tomwoodsradio.com. We're talking minimum wage today. Minimum wage, the fast food protests, the demand for $15 an hour. These issues are not going away. We're going to talk about the economics behind all this, of course, but we're also going to talk about who was really behind these fast food protests. Is it normal? Is it common for people to walk off the job and demand a 100% raise? If it's not, that should make us wonder what's really going on here. And I can think of no one better to help us answer that question than my guest today, Diana Furchgott-Roth. Now, stay tuned after my conversation with Diana for a big announcement I have, or at least it's something I'm excited about. Whether you think it's a big announcement or not, I leave to your judgment, but I'm very excited about it. And also a favor for some qualified person out there who knows audio. So please stay tuned for those two things. But let's talk to Diana Furchgott-Roth, who is the director of Economics 21, which you can visit at economics21.org, and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. She served as chief of staff to the Presidential Council of Economic Advisers from 2001 to 2002 and was the chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor from 2003 to 2005. Diana, welcome to the show.
It's great to be on your show, Tom.
I've been talking to my listeners periodically about this matter of the fast food protests, and I don't want to seem as if I'm heartless or I can't understand the plight of people who have extremely difficult jobs in some cases. I mean, during the off hours, it's not so hard, but you are really on your feet and running around. It's hard work. I understand that. But wishing doesn't make it so. And I guess what annoys me the most about the fast food protests is the mentality according to which if we want people to live in comfort and dignity, well, wishing will make it so. Why? We simply pass a law, and the law will state, from now on, you shall live in comfort and dignity. Now, is that what eats away the most at you also?
I think it's very important that people should be able to live in comfort and dignity. But sometimes a fast food job is the only job they can get when they're just starting out. And I think it's not really possible to expect that someone who is in high school or maybe just out of high school is going to be able to get a job that enables them to live on their own with an apartment. I know that my first job was scooping ice cream at Baskin Robbins. I made about $3 an hour. It was a summer job when I was in college. And most of these jobs are not meant for people to live on. About half the people with minimum wage jobs are under 25. About half of them work part-time. So this is an entry-level job that will get you to the next rung of the career ladder. And it's important that these entry-level jobs are there for people without skills, the way I was one summer in high school and I needed money.
You know, these days it's become fashionable, oddly enough, even among economists, to say, well, listen, you naysayers, the statistics seem to show that a modest increase, now what they're calling for is not a modest increase, but a modest increase in the minimum wage doesn't seem to have serious employment consequences. Now, my response to that in part is, well, there would have been more employment in the absence of the minimum wage hike, but also given how few Americans earn the minimum wage, it's not going to have a huge employment effect anyway in the aggregate because of that, but it will have a big employment effect on the most vulnerable.
That's right, yes. Fewer than 3% of employed Americans earn the minimum wage. And that is because when they get a minimum wage job, they move beyond it very quickly, or they start out with wages above the minimum wage because they have commensurate skill. And what's important is that there be an entry ramp to the labor market for everybody, low skill included. The one particularly vulnerable group is African-American teenagers who have an unemployment rate of 33%. That was in August 2014. And we want to make sure that teens all over, including African-American teens, have an opportunity to have a job and to be productive. And to say that the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, which it is right now, on top of that, employers pay Social Security, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance. That brings the cost to the employer to about $8 an hour. So that means if you have skills less than $8 an hour, you are not allowed to work in the United States. Raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, as some people have proposed, will mean that if you have skills under $11.25 an hour, you will not be allowed to work in the United States. And that's just un-American to say that low-skill workers do not have the right to work, because no one is going to hire somebody with $5 an hour skills if they have to pay them $11 an hour. They're going to hire somebody with $11 an hour skills. But the $5 an hour skill people deserve jobs too.
Well, the propaganda surrounding this whole campaign makes it seem as if the choice we have is either people earn $7.25 an hour or they're going to earn $15 an hour. The possibility that they might earn zero is simply not raised. Again, the mentality is if we want something, we don't try to improve we don't try to increase capital accumulation to increase prosperity for everybody. We just wish we pass laws. Now, in this initiative, they're trying to get $15 an hour wages, which is, as you say in your piece, more than 100% increase. And are they really claiming that this will have no employment effects, or that the employment effects will be so negligible that they're not worth thinking about?
First of all, who the they are is interesting.
Yeah.
It is not clear that it is fast food workers, because if you were a worker and you wanted a raise and you were being paid $7.25 an hour, you wouldn't all of a sudden go out and ask for $15 an hour. You might ask for $9 an hour or $10 an hour. It's unlikely that anyone would right away ask for their wage to be more than doubled. The proponents of this are union-based. There are groups like New York Communities for Change, Jobs with Justice, Fast Food Forward, Fight for 15. They are organized mostly by the Service Employees International Union, which funds Fast Food Forward and other groups, such as Jobs with Justice. They get these people to come out and demonstrate for $15 an hour and pretend that it is really fast food workers who are out on strike. And the SEIU does not really care if there are employment effects at all. They are not representing these people. Jobs with Justice doesn't have to file the financial disclosure forms that labor unions have to file. It's important that when someone comes out on strike, when someone's demonstrating, we see that this is really representative of the group. So with a union, for example, they are elected by their members. Their finances are transparent. They are revealed to the Labor Department, and there are certain criteria that can apply. For example, members can decertify a union if they think the union is not doing a good job, or they can elect new officers. None of this is true with these groups known as worker centers who are organizing these strikes. The fast food workers cannot decertify them. They cannot get rid of them. They cannot see what their finances are. And the object is to unionize these workers, because union membership has been declining steadily over the past 20 years. Unions are not getting enough union dues, both for the political contributions that make them powerful, nor to pay the union officials. So that is who is organizing these, and no, they don't care if additional workers are unemployed, as long as they get more union members.
I see. So the economic analysis is very much secondary, if it exists at all. This is simply an attempt to get publicity and to extend the influence of these organizations, and this could very well be at the expense of the jobs of who knows how many people. Now, I'm looking in your piece here, and I wonder if you could tell us the story about when you were on National Public Radio. You were on Point with Tom Ashbrook. I've been on that show. And you were on with a guest named Terrence Wise, who his story was that he'd been working at fast food restaurants for 18 years, and he was described as 34, homeless, and with three daughters. What happened next there in that conversation, or after the conversation?
Well, I felt very sorry for him, and I wanted to suggest that he get some kind of art training, and there's training available at one-stop centers. There's community college training, and I wanted to call him and suggest he get training in the healthcare area, which is one of the fastest growing sectors. And with training, you can be earning a very, very good a very good salary with opportunities for upward mobility. So I called the producer of the show, the one who booked me on the show, and I said, could I have contact information for Terrence Wise? And much to my surprise, he emailed back and said, I don't have his contact information, but let me give you the name of his publicist. So he gave me the name of the publicist, which turned out to be someone called Danny at Berlin Rosen. I was very surprised at this. I went to the Berlin Rosen website. I found that they have a lengthy list of union clients, including the SEIU. On their website, it says, we help public relations clients articulate their story in a way that persuades and moves. So Terrence Wise might have been the product of a public relations strategy, because it's very unusual that someone works in fast food for 18 years and is homeless and has three daughters. It just didn't make sense.
No, and of course, the turnover rate at these places is extremely high, precisely because people understand it's a step on the ladder. It's not the ladder itself.
Right. There's about 150% turnover rate, which is why, by the way, the SEIU wants to unionize the fast food area. Because in order to join the union, it's not just that you pay union dues. You have to pay a certain amount to join the union. It varies. It's on the order of $50. So they would get all these $50 amounts from people who were joining and then who would leave the union. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And it's also part of the effort, by the way, to have joint ownership of McDonald's and the franchises. This was a National Labor Relations Board move. And that whole attempt was to make McDonald's unionize all the employees in the franchises. That way, all this turnover could work for the benefit of the SEIU, because they would get an influx of initial, not just union dues, but the initiation amounts for sign-up.
Now, there's a very helpful illustration of the effects on employment of increases in the minimum wage that we find, as of June 2013, on U.S. military bases. What is that lesson?
Well, the lesson is that these U.S. military bases cannot operate fast food centers with their higher minimum wage. President Obama raised the minimum wage for contract employees, and some of the fast food restaurants are pulling out of the military bases. So what that meant was that in May, three McDonald's restaurants closed on Navy bases and another on a Marine base, and others have asked to be released from their service contracts because they cannot operate with $10.10 an hour minimum wage. So it's not just the job opportunities for the low-skill workers that are lost, but service members don't have the opportunity to get that inexpensive meal. Because if you go out for fast food with your family, you can go out with a family of four and spend about $20 or $25. If you go to a high-paying restaurant, a family of four, it's about $50. It basically means you can't go out to eat when you're on a low budget.
And that brings up another topic I wanted to raise with you. That's the overall subject of income inequality. And I note here that in June of this year, the Manhattan Institute released a set of essays from economists and writers grappling with this question of inequality. Just the other day, I had Larry Reed on from the Foundation for Economic Education, and I said, as you travel the country, what do you find is the objection to the market economy that you hear most often? And he said, these days, it's just hands down, it's the inequality question. How did you guys handle that issue of income inequality? Is it to say there isn't as much inequality as you guys think? The statistics have been massaged? Or, yeah, there's inequality, but who cares? Or is it both?
What we did was we invited half a dozen authors to a conference and to write short monographs on the subject so that anyone could understand it. And it is on our website, economics21.org, and it's called Income Inequality in America, Fact and Fiction. And the choice of data are very important, and also the demographic issues. The one reason that we have more income inequality is because we have more to earn a family. The people who talk about income inequality often compare it to the 1970s. But what happened in the 1980s, millions of women moved into the labor force. And if you look at characteristics of the top fifth of income earners, they have two earners. If you look at the bottom fifth, it has about half an earner, one earner for every two households, because it has a lot of retirees, it has a lot of singles, it has a lot of unemployed. If you look at the middle fifth, it has one earner. So the best way to have income equality is to require that every household must have only one earner, and every household must have one earner. So just one earner per household. If there's two people who want to work, well, just too bad for them, because it's these two earner couples that help drive the perception of inequality. We also have essays on consumption inequality, because a lot of the studies on inequality measure what's called market income. That's income before taxes are taken out and before transfers are added in. And the top 1% in 2011, the latest data we have, paid 35% of all taxes. The top 5% paid 57% of all taxes. So looking at income before taxes are taken out doesn't really give a true perception of well-being. And these taxes went for programs to help low-income individuals, such as Medicaid, food stamps, unemployment insurance, those kinds of programs. So when you look at the well-being, how much more are the top fifth spending than the bottom fifth? And you look at it over the past 25 or 30 years, the top fifth have been spending about 2.5 times the bottom fifth, if you look at it on a per-person household basis. In other words, per person, someone in the top fifth has been spending about 2.5 times the amount of someone in the bottom fifth. And this has been fairly constant. And why do we get this when incomes have been going up? Well, there are a number of reasons. One of them being the two earners in a household. One are the shrinkage at the bottom end. But also this changes in taxes and transfers.
I think when people are thinking about inequality, they're not thinking in terms of quintiles. They're thinking about the top of the top. They're thinking about extremely wealthy people and their ostentatious displays of wealth. And this seems to grate on a lot of Americans. Now, from my point of view, nothing that these people enjoy in terms of consumption hurts me in any way. They're not taking anything from me. I earn a lot of money from public speaking. My speaking fees are in no way affected by the fact that somebody has a yacht, or my book royalties have nothing to do with the fact that someone has a private plane. It doesn't affect me at all. I'd like to have those things, but I'm perfectly content in my life without them. And the idea of obsessing over the fact that somebody else has them is so utterly foreign to me that I can't even get inside the heads of people who are consumed by this. But that is something that I think people would say to you, which is that we're talking about the top 0.1%, and these people have all this wealth and they use it in socially irresponsible ways.
Well, there aren't very many of these people. It's just a tiny fraction, but yes, they do make headlines. And it's the the politics of envy, which is driving it. There are all kinds of reasons that people make a lot of money. People pay a lot to hear Lady Gaga, for example, so she's very well off. She sells a lot of, CDs, and there's a lot of downloads from her. And there are other people in the financial area who make a lot of money. It's interesting that the Treasury compiles a list of the top 400 income earners every year, not by name. You can't identify them, but what is interesting is that these people turn over a lot. So over the past 20 years, for example, you don't have the same people in the top 400. Some of them are there because they have made a capital gain, or they've sold a large house, and then they go back down again. But the important thing to be concerned about is not inequality, but mobility. If you start out, as I did, with a minimum wage at Baskin-Robbins, can you get the education to be able to work up to the second, third, fourth, fifth quintile? And that's what we need to be focusing on. It's a tragedy that children in inner city schools are relegated to schools where the graduation rate from high school is only 50%. They can't have any chance of a well-paying job or upward mobility if they don't even have a high school diploma. We should close these schools down. We shouldn't be sending our children to schools where the graduation rate is only 50%. If they get a high school diploma and then we guide them to a community college, not even a four-year college, and we guide them to a high-return profession, such as one of the health services professions, such as physical therapy or occupational therapy or being a radiology technician, then they're earning about $40,000 when they graduate from community college. Or if someone's mathematically inclined, something like computer programming. So the big challenge of our time is education and mobility, because earnings are return on skills. If you don't have the skills, you don't get the earnings. And that's what we need to be working on.
There are so many resources now in the age of the internet. There are so many entrepreneurship podcasts, for example, where every day or every week you learn some new resource that can help you, some new idea that you might be able to monetize. There are so many possibilities, and we're still stuck in this old mold of go to school for X number of years and sit there and wait for somebody to think that you're worth hiring, when there are so many other ways, too, for people to find employment. They do need much, much better educational opportunities than they're getting. But then after that, this mentality of, oh, now I'll send out my resume and I'll just sit and wait. You know, and you got to have an entrepreneurial mind that allows you to identify opportunities that are really all around you. Now, this, by the way, this may be dirty pool here, but I saw Mark Perry the other day had a funny graph on the subject of inequality. He's graphed the average U.S. CEO salary, which is $178,400, against the nine-month salary Paul Krugman will earn at CUNY, which is $225,000. And you don't even need any additional editorial comment on that. I just think that chart says a lot, in other words.
Right.
That Paul, he'll spend his time lamenting income inequality, and yet I'm not sure how much of it he's voluntarily divesting himself of. That's just my observation.
Right. Yes. No, that is that's very, very true indeed. We also need to look at regulations in the economy that prevent those people getting jobs. Look at Uber, for example.
Yeah.
Uber is a service where if you have a car, you can go out and you can give people rides. You can answer on your iPhone when people contact you, and it's an informal ride-sharing service. One would think that our governments, federal and state and local, would be very happy about the possibility of people getting informal driving jobs like this and putting together people who want rides with people who want to drive. But no, they're trying to close Uber down. They don't like Uber. They don't like Lyft. They want to regulate everything. And in terms of occupational licensing, there are states that require interior designers to be licensed, florists, hair braiders. They make it as difficult as possible for young entrepreneurs to get jobs. And that is very sad. That's not what we need today.
Diana, before I let you go, can you tell us something about Economics 21?
Economics 21, which you can find at economics21.org, is the economics portal of the Manhattan Institute. We're based in Washington, D.C., And every day we put out an e-brief with the best of the internet together with original content. Today we have a piece on inequality by Scott Winship, who's one of our senior fellows, looking at these different measures of inequality and what they mean. And if anyone wants, they can just go to economics21.org and sign up for our daily e-brief, and they will have the best economics in the internet in their inbox every morning.
Well, it's an excellent resource, and as are you yourself and your archive of columns, which I very much appreciate, as I do your time today. Thank you very much for this very helpful conversation.
Well, thanks so much, Tom. It's been great to be with you.
All right, everybody, let me give you the announcement and the favor request. Let's do the announcement first. The announcement is, years and years ago, I got the idea that it would be nice to have a full-scale Austrian critique, Austrian free market critique of a standard, typical mainstream economics textbook, the likes of which students in colleges encounter every day. Because you can read Human Action, you can read Man, Economy, and State, the major Austrian treatises, and you won't find addressed a lot of the topics and concepts that are introduced in a typical textbook. So where does one go for the Austrian critique of these things? Where does one go for Austrian guidance as to, well, what's right, what's wrong, what's confused, what's partially right in my textbook? And the answer was, there is nowhere to go. That was the answer. That's no exaggeration. There was no such thing as a full-scale Austrian critique of a mainstream economics textbook. Until now, I commissioned such a course because I wanted to see this done, and I'd like to hear it myself, frankly. And I bet you there are a lot of economics students out there who would benefit from it, but not just those, people like you guys who listen to this show, who want to understand the Austrian position better, who want to understand the nature of the disagreements on a whole variety of topics. So what I've done is I commissioned my friend Jeff Herbener, a friend of this show, to go through. He chose Paul Samuelson's book. Paul Samuelson's textbook, Economics, is the best-selling textbook in economics of all time, the Samuelson-Nordhaus textbook. And he went through every single chapter and critiqued it, said, this is correct. This is confused. This is wrong. And sometimes the errors in it are subtle. They're not always sledgehammer errors. And Jeff goes through them with a surgeon's scalpel. And we've now added this as course number 11 at libertyclassroom.com. This course is ready. It's already being downloaded by our members. And as a listener of this show, you can take 50% off at libertyclassroom.com with coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps. If you've been waiting to subscribe, if you've been holding off, this is the time to do it. This course, I think this is actually one of the top 10 best ideas I've had in my entire life. And I have not said that about any other course that we have at Liberty Classroom. They're all great. But in terms of the originality and importance of it, I think this is the most important thing we've got. And here it is. It now exists. I am so thrilled with this. We'll have Jeff on next week. We'll talk about some of these topics. But check that out. And if you know any student in your life who could use a lifeline to professors like the ones at my Liberty Classroom, including me, then a gift subscription there at libertyclassroom.com is just what the doctor ordered. It's courses you can listen to in your car, plus Q&A forums. So I'm making a longer than usual pitch for the site today because I'm so thrilled about the new course. Now, what is the favor that I'm asking? It has to do with audio. I griped to you guys a long time ago that I had a Skype problem, and nobody could quite get to the root of what the problem was, although some people said if you record on two separate tracks, that would solve your problem. You on one track, the guest on the other, that would solve your problem. And that sounded to me like a lot of work, but I've now seen how that's done, or I've seen what Adobe Audition looks like when it's recorded through two separate tracks, and it's actually not hard. I thought it was going to be, I was going to have to sync two separate tracks, and oh, this is going to be terrible. It's actually not hard to do at all, but it's not clear to me how to set it up, how to take the physical equipment that I have and set it up for recording on two tracks. So what I'd like to know is there anybody skilled in audio who happens to live in my area, who happens to live either in the Topeka, Kansas area, which I consider highly doubtful. Nobody in his right mind lives here. My apologies to my few Topeka listeners, but you understand my point, don't you? But anybody in the greater Kansas City area, believe me, I would make this worth your while. I will compensate you more than adequately if you can just come to my office and just take my existing equipment and hook it up so that I can record on two separate tracks. That'll go a long way toward helping me improve the sound quality of the guests who are on the show. So anybody who has any suggestions for this, or who is it, who, if you are yourself qualified to do it, if, in other words, if you know somebody who's qualified or if you yourself are qualified, please drop me a note on my contact page at tomwoods.com. Tomwoods.com/contact is that contact page. That would help me so much if you could do this. All right, that's the favor. That's the great announcement. LibertyClassroom.com with coupon code discount in all caps. Get course number 11 and, of course, all the other courses with your membership there. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next week.
The Tom Woods Show.